Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. The big news out of Governor Phil Scott's weekly press conference Tuesday is that the health department will stop updating its COVID-19 dashboard later this month, even though we've seen a steady rise in infections and hospitalizations over the last 2 months. We also heard a warning from the White House that infections could surge this fall, and that warning is being given as the Biden White House just today says 1 million Americans have officially died from COVID-19. A grim milestone for the country and a reminder that coronavirus hasn't gone away. In Vermont, 648 people have died from COVID, including more than 150 Vermonters so far this year in 2022. If you're sad, if you're grieving, just know you're not alone, and we here at Vermont Edition want you to be reminded that you should not be scared to reach out if you need help. And as we deal with the grim reality, there are still questions about long COVID, boosters, and what we can expect in the months ahead as cases and hospitalizations continue to rise in Vermont. We're going to start with Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine getting us caught up on where the state is today. Dr. Levine, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Great to be back, Connor.
Dr. Levine, as I mentioned in the intro, it was announced that the health department will stop updating its COVID-19 dashboard by May 18th. And that has been the centerpiece of data reporting since March of 2020. What went into that decision and why stop now?
Thanks for asking that question. We've received a lot of feedback about that in both directions, and we're really glad that Vermonters have paid such close attention to our data and use our dashboard because it comes in real time. What we've been saying now, though, is this is not a day-to-day pandemic, and a single day's data does not indicate a trend. People who've heard me speak about this over the last couple of years know my emphasis on knowing when a trend is occurring and when it's not. Now it's time for us to produce data that does reflect trends. So people can look at our new report, which is called the Weekly COVID-19 Surveillance Report, and learn a tremendous amount about trends and learn a tremendous about risk levels in the state. So people can look at this report and the first thing they see is what is our statewide community level based on the CDC criteria. And they can learn about cases, hospital admissions, and numbers of people in hospital beds with COVID over the last 7 days. Very important data. In addition to that, they can learn about something called syndromic surveillance. Now, that may be new to the public, but it's not new to public health. Syndromic surveillance is something that we've used for the flu and other infectious diseases for decades. It monitors emergency department and urgent care visits for people who have symptoms of a specific illness, in this case, symptoms of COVID-like illness. And this is actually really insightful right now, because as I've been saying, we don't have a good insight into cases anymore. Even though we report a case count, that's only the PCR test that people are going to get. It doesn't include the vast majority of the home testing that's being done through antigen testing. And it doesn't really characterize how much of the illness is present across the state. Syndromic surveillance, on the other hand, tells us what percentage of the visits to the healthcare system are with people who have symptoms that are like COVID. So it actually is giving a new glimpse into what's going on and trends in that direction, either more so or less so, and how much burden on the healthcare system these kinds of visits are placing. So I think people will start to get used to this new report and learn that they're gaining a lot more information than they might have been by just looking at a daily case dashboard that wasn't as highly accurate as we would like it to be.
Dr. Levine, speaking about the information that people are getting, we had a listener, Corey, email us and say, quote, I found the weekly data summary difficult to read and decipher. The current dashboard has features that are clearly labeled. No special medical knowledge or graph deciphering skills necessary. Can we expect improvements? This is an important tool in the toolbox for decision-making for many of us.
I think that the new surveillance report is very clear and understandable and will allow it to be actionable by the public. Remember that many people were checking our dashboard to, in a sense, figure out what they should do that day, which is probably not the right way to approach a pandemic, which is not a day-to-day event. We're in it for the long term. So this new report provides information that will help you over consecutive days. Because I'd hate for people to be using information on one day and then changing their behavior the next day as if it was like night and day. We really want them to use trends and then make their decisions about going to large gatherings, going to public settings, wearing a mask, et cetera, based on what we feel is the most up-to-date, comprehensive profile of the disease activity in the state.
Yeah, speaking about trends, it seems like a lot of people are now getting COVID, people who hadn't had it in the past 2 years. Our state data reflects this with the average number of cases each week, and the number of people hospitalized for COVID have been steadily increasing since the beginning of April. What's happening now that people are getting it?
Yeah, so it's very challenging to find a person now who doesn't know someone who's had COVID. The disease has spread much more significantly with the newest subvariants of Omicron, particularly now BA2 and BA212.1, which are overtaking the region. We've noticed in the last week to two that southern New England is now having increasing levels, just like northern New England has experienced. If we look at our seven-day data up until yesterday, there was actually a 10% decline in the number of cases that we measured, which equates to about 175 fewer cases. And our hospitalizations have decreased from a peak, which was in the high 60s, low 70 range, to averaging now more in the 60s, and today actually a level of 52, with only seven in the ICU. So we're seeing a different spectrum of illness. We're seeing a lot more people who are having milder symptoms. Doesn't mean they don't feel ill, but symptoms that wouldn't qualify them for needing to go for emergent or hospital care. And we're seeing a lot more people in the hospital who are there for reasons other than COVID, but are happening to test positive for COVID. And now we're seeing a general low number in the ICU. And my colleagues in the ICU at the medical center inform me that even in that setting, about half of the people in the ICU for COVID are actually not in there because of COVID. They're there for another reason, but have tested positive for COVID. So we're seeing a different spectrum of illness. We hope we've kind of crested the wave, if you will, and that numbers are going to continue to improve over subsequent weeks. It was quite alarming, as you noted, that the president announced not only the concern about the mortality, which is so tragic, but the predictions from the federal government and the modelers for them is that there will be 100 million infections in the fall and winter. Now, I would hope that Vermont and the Northeast would be a little bit spared from that. If it's with the variants that we are dealing with right now that don't seem to be having as much impact on the rest of the country, but are projected to have that impact as time goes on.
I want to go back to what you were talking about when it comes to hospitalizations. Are you saying or implying that people in the hospital are not as big of a concern as they were, let's say, a year ago?
Well, they're always of concern, so don't, I won't frame it with lack of any empathy. But the concern is that at the peak of Omicron, we had more than double this number of people in the hospital. And at that point, we were not only concerned for the fact that people were getting ill, but we were concerned with the capacity of the healthcare system being threatened. And of course, that would mean if somebody came in from an accidental injury or with a heart attack or whatever, that they might be challenged in getting care. Well, fortunately, never during the entire pandemic has that occurred in Vermont. And now we're at half the hospitalization rate of that level. And when you dig into the data, it turns out half of those hospitalizations are actually for reasons other than COVID, even though they're listed as a COVID hospitalization because the person is tested on their way in and tests positive. I'm also noticing that there are remarkably few people, even when they're in the ICU, on a ventilator. And that trend has been very consistent for months now. So even if you're sick enough to get into an ICU, the odds are you're not going to be placed on a ventilator. And I think we all remember the concerns about that from much earlier in the pandemic.
I remember those days when a lot of people, most of America, was very concerned about the shortage of ventilators and people being on ventilators. So a little bit of an encouraging news there. On Twitter, at LiveSciKES points out that nearly 600 new COVID-19 cases reported in Vermont today are, quote, immune evasive. And they link to an article on science.org that calls the new version of Omicron, quote, master of immune evasion. Dr. Levine, can you explain what that means?
Yes, that's immune evasion is listed as one of the core reasons why we're seeing such a large amount of people getting either a positive test or a positive test and a genuine symptomatic infection with the current subvariant of the coronavirus. And they're all subvariants of the Omicron version. So the Omicron version is a more clever version, if you will. The fortunate part about it is it causes consistently milder illness. It hasn't seemed to accelerate the degree of severe illness. But again, I have to emphasize the vaccine, even if it isn't preventing the person from getting an actual infection, is still very, very highly protective against serious outcomes. And people have to keep that in mind, especially those individuals who, for whatever reason, have chosen not to get even the first booster shot. That booster shot is really well demonstrated across the country and across the world in multiple studies, protecting people with a high level of security against serious outcomes. And just having received your initial vaccine series isn't going to cut it with this clever version of the virus.
And listeners, we've heard some of the critiques you voiced when it comes to our pandemic coverage. You wanted other voices besides state officials to talk about their perspectives during the pandemic. To that end, I want to welcome Dr. Tim Plant. He's a general internist and epidemiologist at University Medical Center, and he's also an assistant professor at UVM's Lerner College of Medicine. Dr. Plant, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, Connor, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Plant, can you just tell us a little bit about what it's like treating patients right now and what you and your colleagues are seeing in the hospital?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Connor. And just real quick, I just wanted to say that I'm a physician and an epidemiologist. I practice internal medicine. And all the things I say here are my opinion and don't necessarily reflect that of University of Vermont or the medical center, which I'm employed by both. So, you know, as Dr. Levine has mentioned, you know, it's a very different time now. I wish that we could say this is the third act of COVID, but it's really the third epoch of COVID. You know, back in the original wave, we saw lots of respiratory failure. And then as things evolved and we had highly efficacious vaccinations, we essentially, COVID disappeared over the summer of 2021, and it came back, unfortunately, with rearing its ugly head with Delta and later Omicron. And now in the post Omicron wave, we see a virus now that has transitioned. There's a concept called tropism, which means that a bacteria or a virus affects specific organs. And the tropism for the current Omicron virus is less in the lungs. We're seeing less lung disease, less respiratory failure. It's still there. But we're seeing more systemic conditions.
Can you explain what that means when you talk about, so we're not seeing it in the lungs. I think that's how a lot of people think about this particular virus, is in the lungs. Again, as we talked about with Dr. Levine earlier, that we were all worried about ventilators because this was so much of a lung and cardiovascular disease. So can you just explain a little bit about what we're seeing now?
Yeah, so perhaps a good analogy might be HIV, very, very different virus, and affects the human body in a different way. When HIV came out and was discovered and described, the original term was GRIDS, gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome, to describe the syndrome of lack of immune of immunity. Your immune system basically shuts down in a specific group of people. And that's sort of the image that people have in their mind of HIV. Now in the current time frame, where we have highly effective antiretroviral therapies that transition HIV into being a chronic disease, what we're seeing is HIV dementia. We are seeing HIV-related cardiovascular disease. HIV actually affects, I can't think of an organ system that HIV does not affect. In fact, it goes as far as people with HIV have a greater risk of osteoporosis, low bone density. Now, people are living long lives with HIV, but we're seeing the tropism of HIV in a different way than we did originally. Now, taking that analogy to COVID. So COVID is a multi-systemic virus. It does not just infect the lungs. We've known that. It affects all of many, many parts of the body. It affects the brain, we know now. It affects, it goes as far as the term COVID toes. You get a vasculitis that makes your toes turn funny colors. And we're learning more and more every day about this long-term manifestation of long COVID, which we don't understand. We don't know how to treat. Your risk of getting it is I think potentially a bit higher than people appreciate.
Dr. Plant, I'm just going to jump in here really quickly. I do want to have a further discussion about long COVID with you and Dr. Levine in a little bit, but I just want to stop just right now. And I want to get Dr. Levine's take on these parallels between COVID-19 and HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. Dr. Levine, what are your thoughts?
Now, to expand on what Dr. Plant is saying, we're just seeing more manifestations of the COVID virus that aren't lung focused. We haven't had it around long enough to start talking about it being, a chronic disease. But I think he was trying to get at that when he was speaking about long COVID, that there may be an element of the population that does actually have COVID as a chronic disease. Our goal, though, is that people have the mildest course of COVID they can have, and they try to prevent those kind of issues because vaccination, it's looking more and more, though it's not definitive 100% yet, might be very helpful in preventing the progression to a long COVID situation. It doesn't abolish that possibility, but it does seem to reduce it. And more information is coming in. I also wanted to I'm an internal medicine doctor, just like Dr. Plant, but I do have some input from the pediatric community about what they're seeing now. And certainly in the hospital.
And when you talk about the pediatric community, specifically we're talking about the unvaccinated children ages 0 to 5 right now, ?
Well, no, talking about all ages of kids.
I just wanted to double check.
Yeah. And basically, they're not seeing kids in the pediatric ICU, and when they are, it's because of all the other respiratory viruses that the kids are now getting because we're in a very different environment. When masks came off across the country, all of a sudden there were spikes in disease activity for flu virus, for a host of other viruses that I won't name because they have complicated names, but they're all respiratory viruses we were used to seeing every year and don't see now. And in the outpatient pediatric setting, getting away from the hospital, it's certainly they are seeing respiratory virus and illness like that. But the one noteworthy thing that I think everyone should be aware of, because we've covered this topic many times, is they are seeing a lot of visits related to mental and behavioral health issues. And that is indeed why, as a state, we've been so focused on the health and welfare of our kids, getting them back to school, trying to get their lives back to a pre-pandemic kind of life, and knowing the impact this has had of all ages, but certainly our children, with regard to their mental health.
Certainly a demographic that, you know, I think a lot of parents and older Vermonters are very concerned about. Let's go to the phones and talk to Steve in Fairfax. Steve, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, thanks very much for the phone call and the call. Dr. Levine, just want to say thank you very much for your work so far. It's pretty tremendous. And what an amazing day to be having this call, given that we hit 1 million. Dr. Plant, thank you as well for the work you do. However, I just retired as a respiratory care practitioner. Been one for 40 years. I retired just before the pandemic when Copley Hospital fired me for helping, reminding a visitor in the hallway how to breathe correctly. But the issue is, I've been very proud to be a Vermonter, very proud of the way we handled the pandemic so far. But I'm not happy right now. I don't think that we're playing hardball enough. I really think that the pandemic is not over. I think that mask mandates are a really good idea. Keeping yourself protected is the key thing.
Steve, I think we got it. Thank you so much for that call. I want to start with you, Dr. Plant, when it comes to the state's response. Obviously, there are no statewide mitigations for keeping us protected. Cases are on the rise, hospitalizations on the rise. From your perspective, what should the state be doing?
Well, I'm really glad that I don't have Dr. Levine's job, because that is a million-dollar question. What I can tell you about what we know about COVID, and this was unfortunately only recently well elevated to accepted science, is that COVID is clearly airborne. And we know that if this was a virus or a disease that was transmitted through food or the fecal-oral route, we would be instituting policies and protections that would focus on washing hands and perhaps preparing food in a special way or limiting certain sorts of foods that are higher risk. Now, when you in a viral pandemic, you can't ignore the transmission. And Dr. Levine has been clear in his communications that masks make sense. And at this point, we need to be really thoughtful about how do we limit transmission of potentially the most contagious airborne virus that we've seen ever. That focuses on three specific things. So number one, it's warm weather. Opening windows when it's safe is helpful. It helps bring in clean air from the outside and helps move potential viral particles that are floating in the air to the outside. Number two, air filtration. Now, I would beg to guess that the majority of Vermonters do not have high quality air filtration in their homes or in their workplace. I have no data to back that up, but it's my guess having grown up here. You can very cheaply build a high quality air filtration by making something at home called the Corzai Rosenthal box that you can learn about at cleanaircrew.org. Now, all this is a box that is duct taped together. The sides are MERV 13 air filters. And the top is a 20-inch box fan that blows up. Air comes in through the side, gets clean, and up through the top and gets circulated back into the environment. And these are very cheap and very effective at reducing the virus floating in the air. The third thing is masks, masks, and more masks. The problem is we have, when I go to the grocery store, I see well-intentioned people wearing masks, but they're cloth masks.
And you saw this.
Our cloth masks.
And again, I apologize for interrupting, but you've seen this firsthand with vaccinated patients who got COVID three times in the last 6 months.
Yeah, one of my clinic patients, and I'll change the details for privacy's sake, but one of my patients was admitted to the hospital with severe COVID after several vaccinations, and then has subsequently gotten COVID an additional two times. And this is all since basically the holidays. And, you know, the question that this patient had was why, you know, they thought they were doing everything right. And, you know, we unfortunately didn't have, it was a video visit. I didn't have time to, you know, inspect their masks and see whatnot, but this is a person that works in a sort of office job in a rural area. And they have they're working in an old building with radiators or baseboards or something like that, not a modern HEPA air filtration system. So even if they said everyone's wearing masks, whatnot, if someone walks in, if they have a leak of virus into that airspace, there's nothing to clean it out. They don't have, I said, build a Corzine Rosenthal box. It costs you $70 and, you know, put it in there. Hopefully they don't get infection number four.
And Dr. Plant, so you said that there were three things. I heard open windows, air filtration. What was the third?
Masks, and not any old masks. We need to hang up our cloth masks. Everyone has their favorite masks. You got your favorite socks. It's time to retire our cloth masks. We need high quality masks. They're easy to get. They're cheap, and they KN95s, KF94s, N95s. Find what fits, and I think that people should be wearing it.
And Dr. Levine, you have advocated for people to wear masks. But now, given the state of where we are in the pandemic, how do you respond to Dr. Plant saying that he's advocating for better air quality and more masks?
Oh, absolutely agree. Air quality is something that hasn't been as front and center for the country as a whole as it could be. Fortunately, I know a lot of monies were coming into schools as part of pandemic relief. And a lot of that has been dedicated actually in the school systems to improving ventilation and making sure it's at least assessed well and optimized. So that's very, very important. And again, masks, if we look at the weekly surveillance report, statewide community levels now are on the high side. So we do subscribe to the fact that people should be analyzing their own risk tolerance, looking at their own personal risk assessment, and using a mask to protect themselves in an indoor setting. Now, I would add a fourth thing to what Dr. Plant said, which is think about what you're doing and where you're going and what the level of community prevalence of virus is at the time. Because again, there are indoor gathering settings that may be less safe at a time of high viral transmission than they would be at other times. They may be made safe by good ventilation and adherence to masking, but one has to think about those things before they embark on that journey. So again, think about your own personal risk, who you live with, be civil and understand that there are people who are going to be wearing masks, people who are not. Some might not be wearing masks because they had Omicron 3 weeks ago. And the risk to them now or their risk to anyone else is very, very low. So maybe not wearing a mask is reasonable for them. But at the same time, remember that if you're going to an indoor setting, there are plenty of ways to mitigate your risk, whether it be using a mask, whether it be because the sponsors of the event have said you must be vaccinated if you want to attend. They may have even gone as far as say you must have a negative test on the day of the event or what have you. There are lots of ways when viral transmission is at higher levels that we can respond to that and still live, if you will, with the virus in the background.
Let's go to the phones and speak to Martha in Burlington. Martha, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. My wife is immunocompromised, and I'm wondering how Dr. Levine suggests that we go about our lives day by day as the state health department gives us less information rather than more with its pending change with the dashboard information. I have a dental appointment coming up in a couple of weeks. I have an optometry appointment coming up in a couple of weeks. I count on those numbers to figure out whether to keep these appointments. And the same with my wife. How do you suggest that we proceed once you change the information that you provide to the public?
Dr. Levine, we did get a lot of questions very similar to Martha's concerns.
Yeah, and again, I invite Martha to look at our new report and understand that she's going to be seeing things in a much more aggregate fashion and have more reliable data to work with. So she'll be seeing right up front the statewide community level and the average numbers of cases over a 7-day period. And she should base decisions on that as well as the new syndromic surveillance data, which will show her in a much more accurate way how many people are actually symptomatic with COVID. May not have had a PCR test to show infection, but it shows the burden of symptoms in a way that just looking at a case dashboard can't do. So I would submit that there is going to be no change in the way she approaches her life or her wife's life because of the fact that she'll have data right at her fingertips. And rather than rely on a vacillating daily number that doesn't really look at a rate as well, she'll be able to look at a 7-day performance of the state and then understand how to modify or not her behaviors over the ensuing 7 days. And again, we're in the pandemic, not day by day. We're in it for the long term. So I believe that she should be able to actually do as much with her life decisions now as she was before, because the decisions you make about going to a public setting or wearing a mask should not change from one day to the next. They should be based on what's happening as a trend lately, not on a specific day.
Dr. Plant, we haven't asked you about the state getting rid of its dashboard and going from weekly number or going from daily numbers to weekly numbers. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I have to say I'm a big fan of data as an epidemiologist and a physician, and I think that I myself have made personal decisions and decisions for my family based upon the day-to-day numbers, although you have to take them with a Morton's canister of salt because of the variability. And I agree with Dr. Levine that weekly numbers are probably better. The one thing that I'm concerned about, and we've only seen one of these things, it came out yesterday, is what it's going to look like when the growing pains of producing these look like. So one problem is that it took 3 days after the closure of the monitoring window to produce the report. So it's not a week by week report. It actually tells you details about data that were as far as 10 days ago. And, you know, 10 days ago in COVID time, it seems like decades. I don't know if you
remember. That's an entire quarantine period.
Right. Yeah. And I think we've all had a crash course in epidemiology and biostatistics, whether or not we wanted it as part of this. You know, I guess the silver lining of this pandemic is I no longer have to explain what an epidemiologist is to people. But, you know, the challenge is how do you interpret these data? And if we've sort of been used to seeing what we've been seeing, then relearning that, I think is going to be problematic for folks. I think one last thing that I'm aware of is that and I think Dr. Levine will agree with me, the current Omicron surge started in Vermont. We were the nidus of it, whether it originated here or we just had the detection and ability to report it here. The rest of the country is bracing because of the high quality day-to-day monitoring and numbers that we were providing. And you can see that percolating into New York Times aggregation numbers, into COVIDActNow.org numbers and so on. I guess what I'm worried about is that there's a huge amount of value, not just for Vermont, but for the country, about seeing these live data and also aggregating them sort of on a national scale so that we understand the path and potentially the future of COVID waves as they come. COVID doesn't spread as a light up and down on a dimmer switch through the country. It spreads like waves after you drop a pebble into a pond. And what we're seeing now is the pebble waves, you know, moving across the East Coast and towards the Midwest and down to the South. And that pebble landed right where we are.
Now, we've got several emails about another booster for older Vermonters. Cliff from Dummerston asks, what is the suggested timing for the second booster for people 65 and older? Should we take that now or wait until August or September? Dr. Levine, given the current state of the virus in Vermont and the anticipated trajectory, what is your advice?
Those who are in the higher risk groups, which is in the age group that the caller is in, and plenty of other people who may be older than 50 but have either an immunosuppressive illness or underlying significant medical conditions, this would be as good a time as any rather than wait with that booster. I would in fact say if you're going to wait till August or September, then I'd probably wait till October. And the reason I'm saying that is we will know within the next few weeks if the advisory council to the FDA is recommending a new formulation of the vaccine. That formulation will be more of what I call a pan vaccine. It will incorporate current elements that go way back to the beginning of the pandemic, but it will also incorporate some of the newer variant strains and broaden the immunity that an individual might have. If that is something that's going to be a policy shift for the FDA and the CDC, it will require intensive study, which is already starting over the course of this summer, so that it can then be, if the studies are satisfactory and show great efficacy and great safety, it can then be deployed to the population at large in the fall and winter. So a lot has to happen on a very narrow timeline, but the initiating event for that will be a call for this kind of vaccine to be developed in a rapid fashion. And that will be something that would serve as a much more effective booster than the current version of the booster. So I would err on getting it now if you're in that high-risk group and not wait a few months. But if you're inclined to wait, then you may wait a little longer and see what comes along. But please remember what I said earlier in the call. If you haven't gotten your first booster, that is still the key to success in managing this virus and not developing a serious outcome.
I want to go back to the phones and talk to Roger from Granville, New York, who's been waiting patiently. Roger, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Have a question. Because I'm actually a veterinarian and have been involved in lots of vaccination issues in that. And from the epidemiological standpoint, we are doing a tremendous amount of testing. And coronavirus has been around forever, which COVID is one of them, and it mutates regularly. And the case definition has become that if you're positive to a immunological test or a test for COVID, that you are a case. And typically a case is a situation where, yes, there is an immune response, but there is also symptoms. So one of the things is we've developed very quickly and can be proud of all of the testing we have done, but also we have got to make sure we're getting immunity and to not only the COVID, but other viruses such as flu and that. And I'm wondering if we really need to move to a point where we're not so dependent on this testing, which we probably would have found when we had a bad cold year 10 years ago, a lot of positive tests, and also kind of refine this case definition that, okay, someone that is symptomatic and test positive, but then others that are just getting it. And
Roger, I don't mean to jump in, but I just want to make sure I got your question correct. Are you asking if there's a way we can move past testing regularly and just living with the virus?
Okay, not totally eliminate testing because it's available. but call it for what it is that, yes, you're positive, but not getting the disease. So
I think we got it, Roger. Dr. Plant, how do you respond to that? And how can you answer or help give him better guidance?
So I have to say I'm a little bit lost in the question. I'm sorry, Roger. I was doing my best job taking notes. But I think one of the key things you brought up is the concept of a case definition, which is a core epidemiology public health concept. And that is, how do you determine who in the community has a specific disease? And there's you come up with a case definition based upon best guess and hopefully the gold standard. Now, this current case definition from the CDC is not any test. If you test positive with an antigen test at home, you can bet that you almost certainly have COVID-19, but it's not until you have the PCR. So by the CDC case definition, that does not count towards the case. Now the question I think was also, what happens if you don't have symptoms and you test positive for it? And does that count as a case? Well, yes, we know that people who have COVID, who have no symptoms, can transmit the disease. Just like folks who maybe is asymptomatic from hepatitis C, whether or not you have symptoms from hepatitis C, people can die with hepatitis C, not from hepatitis C. If you have a positive hepatitis C test, you meet the case definition. And, you know, part of the problem is, I think that this was encroached in a lot of the frustration about how we've thought about these, formulating the thoughts about what this disease is and what it means. It is not the common cold. There are a lot of common cold viruses that are coronaviruses. This is special. COVID-19 is its own beast. It's a cousin of SARS from about 20 years ago and MERS, which was in the interim. And we know that these are highly lethal. MERS at least killed about around 1 in 5 to 1 in 2 people who got it. That it's in the same family as the common cold is sort of irrelevant because it's a special virus. And I think it's important to maintain a case definition that considers just a lab test positivity, because we know that individuals who have the virus but no symptoms are still at risk for giving it to other people. And that's consistent with other asymptomatic viruses that cause epidemics and local clusters of issues in communities.
Dr. Plant, I want to ask you, as we're like running low on time and listeners, I see that we have a full call, full list of calls, and unfortunately we don't have any more time to take those. But I want to ask, for people at home, what's the most important piece of advice you can give them when interpreting the data that's given to us?
Well, I think the first step is to take a deep breath. We are in a very different place now than we were back in March 2020. We understand this virus. We understand we have many, many more treatments. Some of them may be short-lived, unfortunately, like Paxlovid, which we didn't get to talk about. But we have numerous treatment options that are out there right now. We have a very effective vaccine at preventing people from getting very ill. We still have big holes in our risk, high-risk people with immunocompromised conditions, kids who are too young for the vaccine. I think that as we move forward, we need to do a much better job at filling these holes in and really having a good barrier as a community to make sure that we can be as healthy as we can move forward. I think what Dr. Levine, one thing I admire about him is that he's reminded us time and time again that Vermont is a community of neighborhoods. We are friends, and we I think we highly respect each other in a way that I think is valuable and makes our state very special.
On that note, Dr. Levine, I would love to hear, with the dashboard going away and weekly numbers, what should Vermonters really be paying attention to when it comes to numbers?
Great. Yeah, let me make two final quick points. People always talk about, are we in endemic yet? And I emphasize, we're not there. We're in a transition phase during the pandemic. So part of that transitioning to endemic is to treat this infectious disease like all the other infectious diseases we follow. And that means we do things like syndromic surveillance and these weekly data reports. has nothing to do with us not focusing on this virus and taking it seriously like we always have. It is just a way of doing this 2+ years in to make sure that people have the most important information they need to make life decisions. The second thing I want people to know, because we've done some recent interviews with a lot of Vermonters, is that you should not underestimate your risk if you get COVID. If you are already in a high-risk group, either because of age or because of other conditions you have, then you need to take a positive test and illness very seriously. And I say that because we have abundant therapeutics in the state right now, especially Paxlovid, which is our go-to drug right now. And we don't want people to say, oh, I'm not that sick, and underestimate the level of illness they might get, because they could get quite ill as the illness progresses.
Dr. Levine, we're going to have to leave it there for now.
In that first...
I want to thank Dr. Levine, the Vermont State Health Commissioner. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Levine.
Thanks as always.
And general internist and epidemiologist, Dr. Tim Plant. Dr. Plant, thank you for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.